peace of such a permanent relationship. They speak of unfettered love, uncomplicated by ritual or legal entrapment. Traditional Judaism places great emphasis on just these institutions. Much of the observant Jew's daily concerns and actions are involved with marriage and the family. How does this tradition sustain itself against contemporary attack? Why should we subscribe to it? What does it have to offer? Questions are, of course, easier than answers. But if there are answers, shouldn't they be heard? In the world of Jewish learning and scholarship, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik is a unique and distinguished figure. The member of a prominent rabbinic family, Dr. Soloveitchik received his PhD in philosophy from the University of Berlin. Living in Boston, Rabbi Soloveitchik commutes regularly to New York, where he serves as professor of Talmud at Yeshiva University. It is Rabbi Soloveitchik who signs all the certificates of ordination for every newly graduated rabbi at Yeshiva. Yet these facts don't begin to tell the full story. One of the foremost thinkers and philosophers of our generation, his classes are filled to overflowing, and his lectures are attended by thousands. He is consulted by leaders in all fields throughout the world. On the occasions I have listened to Rabbi Soloveitchik speak, I have been profoundly moved by his words, words which reflect the complex poetry of the soul. Perhaps the true mark of the man lies in the fact that once, when asked for a suitable introduction, he said, "Tell them I am a teacher."
I'm going to speak about the biblical philosophy of marriage. And of course, the text is the story of creation and Eve. There are two basic philosophies about the axiology of the institution of marriage. One theory, or one philosophy, develops a system of transunit, external semantics of marriage. And the other one has developed an immanent matrimonial axiology. One theory discovered the meaning of matrimony outside of, and the other one within the matrimonial union. According to the proponents of transient axiology, or external axiology, marriage is committed to the promotion of the welfare of the group. The survival of the latter is the main goal pursued by two individuals united in marriage. Whether the term group is understood in a liberal fashion, at the level of human universality and equality, or group is mankind, or the human race as such, or the term group is interpreted in a restrictive manner, confining it to a particular community, a religious, national character, is irrelevant. What is significant in the theory of external semantics is the idea of the sovereignty of the collective over the individual, and that marriage actually places the two individuals at the service of society. Basically, the theory of transient axiology is not only a collectivist, but a positivist, naturalistic doctrine as well, denying the unique and specific in the marital union of two humans, and seeing it within the natural scheme of things, comparable to the process of pollination in the vegetative world, or seasonal mating in the zoological kingdom, where indeed the existence of the individual, of individual plants or animals, makes sense only within the context of the species. In contrast
to the positivist collectivist theory of knowledge, the theory of immanent axiology shifts, as I hinted before, the center of gravity from without to within the matrimonial union. According to this theory, marriage is to be axiologically interpreted not only in terms of collective utility, but mainly in those of personal experience, enriching and enhancing the lives of two individuals who were drawn to each other. Then this theory of immanent semantics argues thirst for love and fellowship. It craves to live in community, for personalistic union, for sharing his destiny with somebody of the opposite sex. It is in marriage, this theory maintains, that man finds fulfillment. Procreation, according to this philosophy, is not the central theme of marriage. A childless marriage is just as sacred and significant as one blessed with offspring. Since the meaningfulness of the matrimonial union is to be found in self-fulfillment of the wedded partners themselves, rather than in the benefits which accrue to society. Thus, matrimonial individualism superseded matrimonial collectivism, and matrimonial romanticism replaced matrimonial utilitarianism. Basically, the individualistic theory of marriage is romantic in its essence. When we examine this controversy in the light of the biblical story of creation, we discover that the Bible operates with both motifs, the objective transient and the subjective immanent one. In the first account of creation of man, the sex union of male and female, and interestingly, the Torah uses Zohar and Keva, which is very indicative of men and women in physiological terms. The sex union of male and female serves one task only, namely that of procreation. The propagation of the race is the overriding motif, if not the motive, of the sex union. However, in the second account of creation, we encounter a completely different axiology. The meeting of Adam and Eve, of men and women, Zohar and Keva don't appear anymore. Instead, Ish and Isha appear. Is precipitated by the feeling of loneliness and by the basic need for companionship. The cause of marriage, according to the second account of creation, is the exasperating and desolate feeling of loneliness. The goal of marriage is the redeeming experience of life and fellowship. Vayimer ad Hashem Elokim letov yotzer adam levadei, eser le'yezer kenegdei. And the Lord God said, it is not good for man. Not good that man shall be alone. I shall make him a help opposite him. While the first account deals exclusively with the physiological sex differentiation of male and female, Zohar and Keva Boreism, and their joint capacity for procreation, the second account has completely omitted this aspect of the male-female relationship. Neither the physiological fact of bisexuality, nor the biological moment of reproductivity is mentioned in the second account. the blessing or the summons of Pruvu was imparted to an anonymous male and an unknown female, was not imparted to an anonymous male, an unknown female, but to two personae, Adam and Eve. In contrast to the sex polarity of Zohar and Kevah, the Bible speaks in the second account as Ish and Isha, man and woman, as Ezer Kenegde, as a help opposite him. Apparently, God was concerned, according to the second account, not with the biological motives and goals, with the meeting of male and female for the express purpose of procreation, but with the spiritual incompleteness of lonely man and his need for ontological oneness, ontological existential oneness with another individual. In words, the focal point in the second story of the emergence of man is not the biological urge, but the tragic of man, who as the only conscious being in creation is well aware both of his greatness and vast opportunities which lie before him, and of his inner contradictions, imperfections, and final defeat. Interesting is the sudden and prima facie unwarranted departure by the Bible from the narrative about the creation of Eve, and the focusing of attention on another episode. Let us read the text carefully. And the Lord God said, "It is not good for man to be alone. I shall make him a help opposite him." And out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field, and every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field, but for Adam there was not found a help suitable for him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep. By telling us about the episode, the Bible is not out emphasized that God was searching not for a sex male, but for a spiritual. The Bible is out emphasized that God was searching not for a sex male, but for a spiritual partner, for another person. The Bible tells us that there could be no communication or living in community between Adam and some subhuman creature. And therefore God had to create another human being. Had God been interested only in the physiological aspect, the Bible feels there would have been no need for the emergence of Eve. Another subhuman female perhaps could have filled the void. Since, however, God was searching for a helper, a friend, a partner, who could join Adam to form an existential community with him, not another female, but another person had to appear. Not another female, but another person had to appear. In short, God was exploring nature not for a sexual mate, but for another self. Therefore, the Lord God caused the deep sleep to fall on Adam. That's why the moment the story started, God said the man should not be alone. It's not good for men to be alone. And suddenly the terror starts to tell us another story. The continuity, prima facie, is interruption. That God brought all the animals, the fowl of the air, to Adam and then Adam named them, classified them. And the Torah concludes, Ulodom Limot Reizakanele. And as far as man is concerned, they did not find a helper. He had to create a helper. What the Bible tries to emphasize is to emphasize is the following thought, that God was not interested in finding another female, but another person. That's why a subhuman female could not feel the void. And therefore, God had to create Eve, another person, another friend, a friend, a helper, somebody can stand opposite him and be an equal. Then Eve was not created of the dust of the ground, but of the rib of heaven. The moment of oneness is symbolized by that. Why the rib of heaven? This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. The language is replete with metaphors. However, the unity here is not of a physical, but rather of a personal, existential nature. The sex impulse is, of course, a powerful catalyst which accelerates the establishment of the existential community by two adventurous individuals who emerge from their solitude and join in each other in their quest for ontological fullness and greatness. The Bible stresses the singularity of this kind of fellowship in which two personae different in temperament, in thinking, mode of reacting, different in experiencing things and events, find self-fulfillment in each other. The Bible stresses that by stating, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and he shall cleave unto his wife, and he shall be one flesh. Why was it necessary for the Bible to say? Again, oneness of the flesh is to be interpreted as a metaphor indicative of complete unity, of a community of souls which comes into existence under the pressure of the sexual urge. What is most significant in the above quoted biblical passage, what is the most significant actual statement here, is the fact that the Bible has compared the relationship between Adam and Eve to death prevailing between child and parent. Okay, as a vision service image, he leaves his parents, father and mother, and he will join his wife. Moreover, the Bible lets the matrimonial community replace the natural parent-child community with the child, the son, for instance, who was a member of a community, a parent-child community, he needs that community now. He joins another community, namely, men and women community. Both the analogy and the substitution cast their light upon the biblical philosophy of marriage and places the latter in a unique metaphysical frame of reference. The bond, let us understand, the bond between child and parent, when the former reaches maturity, of course, is completely divorced from any hedonic, egocentric motivation. Of course, as long as the child is young and independent from father and mother, then, I mean, the relationship is a pragmatic one, a utilitarian one on the part of the child. He needs the father, he needs the mother. You know, it cannot exist without the father, without the mother. Then it's egocentric. The bond is egocentric and utilitarian. However, when the child grows up, he doesn't need the father, nor does he need the mother. But he still belongs into that community. So the bond is not utilitarian or egocentric or selfish anymore, but should be interpreted in terms of love of a higher quality, which is rooted in the awareness of unqualified unity on the part of both parent and child. There is a steady outpouring of the heart of the parent toward the son or toward the daughter. And conversely, there is a continual act of identification of the son with the parent, mother or father. The relationship is not a practical one, it's not a pragmatic relationship. It is a metaphysical existential relationship. Somehow there is an act of identification on the part of the son with the parent, and the son says, I. It means the I embraces two people, two or three people. Himself, him, the son, and father and mother as well. And father, this is certainly true of father, and the father and the mother say, I, so the child is included in the I, is a part of the I. It is, there is existential identification with each other. And that's why our Torah has emphasized time and again the significance of the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avim. There is an existential give and take relationship between parent and child. They both depend existentially, not pragmatically, existentially, upon each other. The dependence between parent and child is reminiscent of the dependence prevailing between the tree and its roots. What chances of survival has the tree whose roots have died? And of what use are the roots if the tree has been felled by the axe? Suspended in midair is the son who drifted far from his origin, from his parents. He must feel, if he is sensitive enough, if he is human, he must feel a devastating loneliness. He must burn with his thirst, since the cool, crystal clear waters of the spring well from which he removed himself in a fit of rebellion and anger are almost at an endless distance away from him. Vice versa, one should endlessly pity the parent who in his or her mad rush for success and riches lost his or her son, since all the riches that were assembled turned into dreadful poverty, and a bright day full of fragrance, sound and color turns into a dreary cold autumnal night if a parent loses a child. And the same is true if a child who loses a parent. The halacha has emphasized time and again the unique nature of the parent-child relationship. In fact, it has introduced into this relationship a transcendental motif and equated it with the relationship binding man to God. The origin perception is characteristic of both. What binds man to God? The same motif that binds man to his parents. Finite man searches irresistibly for his antique existential roots. Man wants to get as close to his existential roots as possible. He questions himself and keeps on interrogating his mind and his soul, inquiring of them, whence comes this paradoxical existence? Whence the beauty, joy, and ecstasy of being just a human being, who, unlike the animal, transcends the biological natural dimension? Whence comes the sweet assurance that one is, that simply the assurance, the awareness that I do exist now, at this moment? The answer is quite often slow in coming. However, when it finally does come, this answer, meaning pointing out to man the origin and source of being, it strikes man with an elemental force. It is straight and unequivocal. In fact, the answer does come in form of a revelation or in the form of a living perception rather than in that of a lifeless abstract conception. Suddenly, the darkness dissipates, the horizons become brilliantly illumined, and man sees God, and while seeing Him, he comes upon his ultimate true antichrist. But there is something strange about Johannes. Yet the encounter of man and God can only occur if man in his quest for the great ultimate and eternal good is also concerned with the little, conditioned, and transient, this worldly needs. He is looking for two kinds of needs, for the ultimate transcendental only good. He is also looking for another good. A conditioned truth, a transient truth, a disorder. Only after finite man had recognized and acknowledged his dependence upon someone in the here and now reality does God bestow upon him the illuminating consciousness of the dependence upon the one and only unity. First man has to find his condition truth, finite truth in this world, not in the transcendental reality. First man must find another person, actually, upon whom he is dependent existentially, ontologically. Of course, the person itself is not an ultimate truth, because he himself is dependent upon someone else, and etc., etc. But one cannot find the absolute, eternal root of existence if he does not discover, prior to that, the transient, temporal, and conditioned root in this world. As stated above, man seeks the great ultimate root of all being. Of course, he seeks it in infinity, and he finds it in God. Man also explores at the same time the finite realm, moving along on its path in his search for the limited and conditioned truth of his being, and in so doing he discovers his strength. There's the finite truth in this world. Who is it? I find the finite root. Where can I find the finite root? At this station in the time. As we have already stated, Judaism, with its characteristic sense of realism, considers the root quest within here and now reality as the reflection of the primary search of the absolute, origin. Which man tries to find beyond the bounds of sensuous reality. The Jew learned to confess his faith in and his impatient yearning for God by telling the story of people whom he loves and with whom he seeks to identify himself. By loving God, one loves, by loving the parents, one loves God. Because it's one love, it's one source, it's one urge. It's the urge of finding, discovering the root of my being, or the origin of my being. In Hebrew it's beautiful, in the makor, in the Greek, the archaic being. Judaic faith and theology are linked to this finite experience and meaningful human relations. By developing proper human relation structure, the Jew learns how to love, revere, and commit himself in an ultimate manner to the Almighty. But remember that we have to develop proper relational structures in this finite world, you'll never find God. And Bach Nisse, the basic religious experience in Judaism, is the one of gratitude, thankfulness. However, man has to learn thankfulness in this world. To be thankful to his father, to his mother, to his teacher, to his friends who helped him. And if we learn how to be thankful to finite beings, you'll discover the great secret. How one can express gratitude to the eternal, to the Almighty. The same is true of man's search for the origin, for the root. The Torah tells him, find the root for the time being in this here and now reality. It's not a true root. It is just it is transient, it is temporal, it's conditioned, but found. Once you find it among people, you'll be able to explore the transcendental realm beyond the bounds of here and now reality. When the son finds his finite conditioned origin, his father or his mother, the ipso facto discovers his infinite and ultimate origin in God. However, it is impossible to discover the mysterious transcendental origin if the individual is not acquainted with the origin perception of belonging to and being rooted in something or someone within the range of the finite and tangible world. Picking up our original theme, we realize that on the strength of the comparison, indeed equation, of the matrimonial community with that of the parental, the former, means the matrimonial community, is as interwoven in the texture of man's metaphysical nature and his theological quest for the origin which cross the frontiers of finitude. Not only the parental, but also the matrimonial community is a reflection of and prologue to the exalted community of man and God. In both communities, the theme of the origin is of central significance. And in both, men experiment, like a scientist in a laboratory, with the great origin adventure, which will take him along the uncharted plains of creation to the boundary separating finitude from infinity. It's not only the parental community, it's the matrimonial community, leading to our great goal, namely the discovery of the true ultimate, the root of existence. In recapitulation, let me say that the Bible has placed emphasis on procreation as the motif and objective of the meeting of male and female. However, the context in which this procreative urge as being mentioned in the Bible is that of natural man who is immersed in non-purged and non-redeemed existence. Obviously, at the level of naturalness and immediacy, the sex meeting, as it is the case with the animal, represents the elan vital or the biological push which is focused upon the race or the species rather than on the individual. Since within the natural scheme of things, the individual finds himself in bondage to the species. In this context, the individual, instead of acting spontaneously, reacts compulsively to mechanical pressure of its own insensate nature. The individual is able neither to master nor to sublimate the biological urge. Then the natural drives of the individual, in particular, the sex drive, aim at the survival of the collective. In a word, at the natural plane, at the plane of naturalness, the Bible agrees with the positivists that the sex union pursues an extraneous goal and does not serve the individual, since natural man is a stranger to himself and lacks the very existential experience of himself as an I. This is, in essence, the first story of creation of man. But it is applicable to natural man, primitive man. And I always say, when I speak primitive natural man, I don't have in mind, I mean, a primitive in terms of anthropology, caveman or jungle. He can be a great philosopher, a great engineer, a great mathematician, but still remain a natural, a being locked up within the dimension of naturalness. He is not capable of transcending himself. So the theory of co-creation is quite applicable to such man. It's more, when I say primitive man, it's more in terms of typology than in those of anthropology. With this emergence in the second chapter of Genesis of spiritual man, the transhumed naturalistic semantics had to be replaced by another set of inner individualistic semantics. The greatness and dignity of spiritual man consists exactly in his complete liberation from servitude to the class or species, in his substituting inward centeredness for outward surface existence. I mean, this is my manner, so I remain with him, sir, that the main task that man has to implement is to liberate himself from the species and become an individuality. And this is also true in the philosophy of marriage. As long as man is a member of the species, is a member of mankind, represents mankind, I mean, at the level of naturalness, so man cannot redeem, actually, his experience, and actually his marriage serves the collective. But however, the liberation of man from the group means with the attainment of individuality and uniqueness on the part of man, then his whole approach to the marriage philosophy, to marriage, changes. Within such a context, marriage had to assume different meaning, expressing not only the need of the race, but also and perhaps mainly the desire of the human individual. Within the frame of reference of the human personality, even the productive, reproductive urge is no longer to be interpreted in terms of biological mechanics, serving blindly an extraneous group, but is nurtured by teleological, axiological motifs. In fact, the Halacha has interpreted the divine blessing of poor womb, be fruitful and multiply, in normative terms. It's not an age, according to Halacha. According to Halacha, it is a norm. Usually, Prayim Alekim, poor womb, middle words, or do words of Hashua, is an urge. It's a drive. God implanted a drive in there. But still, the Halacha says it, poor womb, I mean, it constitutes the first norm in our Torah. It's the first norm of Tayag Mitzvah. Because Allah took the urge and raised it to a level of normative thinking and normative experience. Procreation is not only a biological capacity with which God provided man, but an Allahic commitment as well with which God charged man. This mechanical motivation and biological push have been, as far as spiritual man is concerned, sublimated and raised to a level of ethical meaningfulness and intentionality. We deal no longer with mechanical motives, but with spiritual purposiveness. Men and women replace male and female, and their meeting presses for a more exalted togetherness experience, whose aim is not only the survival of the race, but also the extension, the formation and extension of a small, modest community. In a word, the marriage rises from the level of naturalness to the level of personalism and spirituality, so the matrimonial union becomes a community. The equation of the matrimonial relationship with the parental one and the substitution of the former for the latter of any other physical image holds the key to the teleology of marriage of spiritual man and woman. Let's develop this idea. The marital community which supersedes the parent-child community must in turn become a parental community. There is a parental community. Then the woman comes along as a mother and then leaves the parental community. And it forms another community with the woman emerge. The parental community falls apart. A new community rises. But this community will also become a me, I mean, is bound to become a parental community. While spiritual man in his search for an existential partner destroys the child parent community and founds upon its ruins his own miracle community, his triumph is of transitory nature. His goal will not be achieved unless the matrimonial twofold community is elevated to a parental threefold community, which in turn will be disrupted again by spiritual man of the succeeding generation. And through experiencing this dramatic flow of events of destroying in order to build and building in order to be destroyed, man realizes his quest for the origin of source and gradually moves closer and closer to God. The Halacha has merged both accounts of creation of man into one section, in which biological motives and teleological commitments are interwoven. If seen from the Halachic viewpoint, matrimonial community is not realized without embracing three personas. The matrimonial community is not a two-personal community. It's a three-personal community. At this level, marriage redeems the productive urge from its animal species orientation and turns it into a spiritual, tragic longing of man for his origin and source. The instinctive roar of the animal, driven by biological pressure, and pushed mechanically to the female in order to reproduce, becomes, as far as spiritual man is concerned, a human metaphysical cry of lonely man and lonely woman for fatherhood and motherhood. Judaism disagrees with both theories. Accordingly, it refutes the collectivist theory. According to Judaism, the collectivist transient semantics theory is workable in the world of natural man. There is, however, no validity when extended to spiritual man, since the dignity of the latter is lost in such a philosophy of marriage. If you say marriage serves the group, not the individual. If procreation of children at the natural biological level is the sole purpose of marriage, and that's what the positivist, claim, then Judaism asks, well, why not do away with the whole institution? Let men and women lead a promiscuous life, and the cause of reproduction will be well served. As a matter of fact, totalitarian government toys with this idea. Nazi Germany tried to practice that. Even communism, first year, was also toying with the idea of abolishing the marriage institution, and simply,
simply replace the sex relations, promiscuous sex relations.
Of course, the proponents of the collectivist theory will meet this argument with the explanation that procreation includes not only biological conception and birth, but also the intellectual and moral upbringing of the child as well. Promiscuity, the proponents say, of collectivist theory say, would hinder the moral and cultural development of the child. Therefore, they argue, it is worthwhile to maintain and protect the institution of marriage. Exactly what the communists say, what Lenin said. However, we may ask, why not entrust the state with the task of educating the child in both elements? And again, experiment on a DNA. Not only DNA, that matter of fact in Russia and other countries, particularly in China, after the child is brought up not by the parents, but by the state. However, we may ask, why not entrust the state with the task of educating the child in both elements, the technical, scientific, and spiritual moral? Moving down the law, we may ask, the positive is that only father and mother united in matrimony are fit to perform this mission. On the other hand, Judaism maintains that to base marriage on subjective love and subjective happiness experienced by two individual partners united in matrimony as the romanticists with their theory of immanent semantics try to do is a very risky undertaking. Who knows what genuine love is? And who can guarantee that this sentiment will not exhaust itself with the passage of time, the experience of boredom and fatigue engendered by monotony? In fact, the trouble with modern marriages, basically, stems from the overemphasis placed on the element of subjectivity in marriage. In general, to exclude the child from the marriage semantics or axiology and teleology is a result of selfishness and short-sightedness. The halacha says marriage fulfills the basic need of the human personality, namely the need for existence in community. However, this community can only be attained through the quorum required by God in his original scheme of creation. The quorum consists not of two, but of three people, and one of the three is the child. In the threefold community, the two original partners find their happiness and self-fulfillment in the threefold community, not in the twofold community. Moreover, this is very important, one craves not only for love to be bestowed upon him. Of course, the person wants to be loved, no doubt. Particularly women wants to be loved, no doubt about it. But there is another urge in marriage. When I say men, I mean women and men. Men want very much. I mean, yes, procreation is not only a biological capacity with which God provided man, but an halachic commitment as well with which God charged man. This mechanical motivation and biological push have been, as far as spiritual man is concerned, sublimated and raised to a level of ethical meaningfulness and intentionality. We deal no longer with mechanical motives, but with spiritual purposes. Men and women replace male and female, and their meeting stresses for a more exalted togetherness experience, whose aim is not only the survival of the race,
but also the extension, the formation and extension of a small matic community. In a word, the marriage rises from the level of naturalness to the level of personalism and spirituality, so the matrimonial union becomes a community. The equation of the matrimonial relationship with the parental one and the substitution of the former for the latter, obtained out of the previous image, holds the key to the teleology of marriage of spiritual man and woman. Let me develop this idea. The marital community which supersedes the parent-child community must in turn become a parental community. There is a parental community. Then the woman comes along with magic and then leaves the parental community and it forms another community with the woman in there. The parental community falls apart. The new community rises. But this community will also become a new family. It's bound to become a parental community. While spiritual man in his search for an existential partner destroys the child-parent community and founds upon its ruins his own miracle community, his triumph is of transitory nature. His goal will not be achieved unless the matrimonial two-fold community is elevated to a parental three-fold community, which in turn will be disrupted again by spiritual man of the succeeding generation. Through experiencing this dramatic flow of events of destroying in order to build and building in order to be destroyed, man realizes his quest for the origin of thought and gradually moves closer and closer to God. The Halacha has merged both accounts of creation of man into one section in which biological motives and teleological commitments are interwoven. If seen from the halachic viewpoint, matrimonial community is not realized without embracing three persona. The matrimonial community is not a two-persona community. It's a three-persona community. At this level, marriage redeems the productive earth from its animal species orientation and turns it into a spiritual, tragic longing of man for his origin and source. The instinctive roar of the enemy, driven by biological pressure and pushed mechanically to the female in order to reproduce, becomes, as far as spiritual man is concerned, a human metaphysical cry of lonely man and lonely woman for fatherhood and motherhood. Judaism disagrees with both theories. Accordingly, it refutes the collectivist theory. According to Judaism, the collectivist transient semantics theory is workable in the world of natural man. Has, however, no validity when extended to spiritual man, since the dignity of the latter is lost in such a philosophy of marriage. If you say marriage serves the group, not the individual. If procreation of children at the natural biological level is the sole purpose of marriage, and that's what the claim, then Judaism asks, why not do away with the whole institution? Let men and women lead a promiscuous life
and the cause of reproduction will be well served. As a matter of fact, totalitarian governments toyed with this idea. Nazi Germany tried to practice that. Even communism, first year, was also toying with the idea of abolishing the marriage institution and simply replace it with sex relations, promiscuous sex relations. Of course, the proponents of the collectivist theory will meet this argument with the explanation that procreation includes not only biological conception and birth, but also the intellectual and moral upbringing of the child as well. Promiscuity, the proponents say, as collectivist theory say, would hinder the moral and cultural development of the child. Therefore, they argue, it is worthwhile to maintain and protect the institution of marriage. That's exactly what the communists say, what Lenin said. However, we may ask, why not entrust the state with the task of educating the child in both elements? And again, experiments of DNA. Not only DNA, as a matter of fact, in Russia and our country, particularly in China, after the child is brought up not by the parents, but by the state. However, we may ask, why not entrust the state with the task of educating the child in both elements, the technical, scientific, and spiritual moral? Who laid down the law, we may ask, the positive is that only father and mother united in matrimony are fit to perform this mission. On the other hand, Judaism maintains that to base marriage on subjective love and subjective happiness experienced by two individual partners united in matrimony as a romanticist with a theory of immanent semantics try to do is a very risky undertaking. Who knows what genuine love is, and who can guarantee that this sentiment will not exhaust itself with the passage of time, the experience of boredom and fatigue engendered by monotony. In fact, the trouble with modern marriages, basically, stems from the overemphasis placed on the element of subjectivity in marriage. In general, to exclude the child from the marriage semantics or axiology and teleology is a result of selfishness and short-sightedness. The halacha says marriage fulfills the basic need of the human personality, namely the need for existence in community. However, this community can only be attained through the quorum required by God in his original scheme of creation. The quorum consists not of two, but of three people, and one of the three is the child. In the threefold community, the two original partners find their happiness and self-fulfillment in a threefold community, not in a twofold community. Moreover, this is very important, one craves not only for love to be bestowed upon him. Of course, the person wants to be loved, no doubt. Particularly women wants to be loved, no doubt about it. But there is another urge in marriage. When I say men, I mean women and men. Men want very much. I mean, really, it's a lonely individual commits himself a priori, fully and unreservedly. He wants to love somebody who exists. He wants to love somebody who doesn't exist, hasn't come into existence yet. The two lonely individuals with their urge to love are committed to creativity in order to love someone who will in the course of time emerge as a new member of the small community they founded together. This someone who is as yet hidden in the recesses
of anonymity, of non-being, in the sense of anonymity of non-being, will give purpose and meaning to the community and help father and mother to find themselves and their exact position in the universe. To repeat, the need for loving finds fulfillment in the act of creation. The I summons the Tao into existence, to use an existential term, in order to shower upon him love and affection. This is exactly what Prabhu means. Loving means ecstatic gazing at a Tao who belongs to and is rooted in the eye. But the Tao sometimes is real, at times he is not real again. In this context, we may say that sex love is the expression of the powerful will to create in order to love, to give up oneself not only to others who do exist, but also to those who don't exist as yet and who will at some point in time demand of the Creator love, care and devotion. Two lone individuals meet and vow faith in each other, they form a community, but they also vow faith in someone who is yet unknown. They are driven by a natural sex instinct, the two individuals, which is employed by the Creator in order to fulfill an ethical metaphysical knowledge, afilum chesed yibane, to create in order to be sorted. Upon one in marriage, man is summoned to cast his glance not only outside of himself, namely at the woman partner, but also at the other side of being, at a child whose name is not as yet to be found in the register of creation. You cast the glance not only at the woman. The woman attracts your glance if she's good looking, fair. But you cast the glance at the mysterious someone, a child whose name is not has not appeared yet in the register of being creation. And here I want to simply to make an excursion into a theological field. Fundamentally, man imitates his creator. God created the world, and that is known in the name of the Ariya Kodesh, Afnula Khibhipatnuya. For what purpose? Because he wanted to give up himself to something outside of himself. Eimon Chesed Yimon, the urge to create the world, was Chesed. Yet, the act of creation of the world contains an awesome dichotomy of which our mystics were well aware. There's a simple problem. God is infinity, all-inclusive and all-exclusive. He embraces everything and he negates everything. There is no doubt. There is no I. There is only He. The ontology of the book of Exodus taught us that God is existence par excellence. The exalted name of Eya Shereya, I am what I am, was interpreted by both Pharaoh and Maimonides as expressing the equation of divinity and existence. Whatever exists, exists in Him, by Him and through Him. Ontological autonomy of creation contains a contradictio in adjecto. Consequently, to say that there is a separate world which confronts God as an entity per se would be sheer absurdity. Nevertheless,
we Jews believe in the act of creation. And we speak of the triple relationship, God-man and the world. We have always rejected the crude pantheism of the mystics, which identifies God with the world. How could the world be created? The question rises, how could the world be created outside of God, since there is no outside? How could he empower an infinitesimal spark as his being to something or somebody outside, in quotation marks, as him? Does not finite plus infinity equal infinity? The rule of mathematics, the finite number and infinite number added up is infinite. This antinomy will of course never be resolved. It will remain a mystery, a mysterium magnum. However, the mystics, who many a time substituted symbol for concept and sensuous metaphor for abstract thought, equated creation with a movement of recoil on the part of God. The Almighty, they said, sacrificed his own inclusiveness, his own consuming infinity, and withdraw from a here and now coordinate system and retreated into transcendence in order to let the world emerge outside of him. It was retreat on the part of the Almighty. He created a world. Why did he retreat? Why did he create the world? In order to care for the world. He created the world, creation itself is sacrifice. Because God has retreated into transcendence in order to leave, so to say, a vacuum or a void to be filled by so-called world. The Almighty, they say, that's all right. He created the world in order to care for sustainable world. Creation, according to the mystics, is sacrificial divine action. God retreated and left a void for the universe to fill. Similarly, the two lonely human beings who are driven to creativity by their yearning for giving and bestowing love, engage in sacrificial action and offer everything they cherish for the sake of the new member, the way God sacrificed in order to bring about the world, because he wanted the world in order to care and for and to love the world. Take of a new member by withdrawing from self-centered love into chesed-oriented community, which binds man to a life yet unborn. Basically, child is a burden of God. They have to give up part of themselves in order to raise the child, to rear the child, to educate them. Everybody knows. And when I say burden, I don't mean to use the term, in a pragmatic sense, simply the mother has no time, the father is busy, the child interferes with education, the child interferes with leisure time which they used to enjoy when they were just, when the community consisted of two members. I don't mean in this sense, I mean it is existentially a burden, because of my awareness, as long as I'm single, my awareness is centered around myself. I care for myself, I like myself, I look out for myself. Everything is measured, everything is interpreted in terms of self-centeredness. And I'm not critical. When I marry already, I give up part of my self-centeredness. I take in somebody else. Somebody for whom I didn't care. Months before, half a year ago, I didn't know of the existence of that somebody.
But now he shares already my eye awareness, this itself is a sacrifice. Like God, when he thinks of himself, he thinks also of the world. Then the child comes, then the parents, both father and mother, bring it, a sacrifice. Because the child not only will have to share our awareness with the child, but the child will somehow become the center of the world at the time. And this itself is a movement of support. It's retreating from self-centeredness into a world of happiness. You sacrifice not the question of material welfare or leisure time or opportunity, educational opportunity. You sacrifice your existential awareness. And the child will not only share in that awareness, he will be the central figure. And you will forego many things in order to please the child. Adam said, therefore shall man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Rashi made the following comment. Avlad nisa alivishmeh. They shall be one flesh with the child who is created by both of them. In other words, the realization of the idea of marriage is attained according to the Bible with the child. And that's exactly how the Bible portrays marriage. According to the Bible, marriage is motivated first by a physiological urge. But this physiological urge is redeemed and raised into an experience of loneliness. The experience of loneliness makes man meet someone else, another person, not a female, another person, and the opposite sex, but a person. And this personal meeting of two lonely people results in the matrimonial community. But the matrimonial community is not complete if the third member is not included. Because the matrimonial community wants to love someone is not wants to love and wants to betray him. To summon a person into existence in order to bestow upon him love and attention and devotion. And the matrimonial community finds its full fulfillment in a threefold community in which the child is pleasing to them. That's the power of nature. I decided to leave the rest. Another question.
Ready? A number of, many young adults are in the present age rejecting civil marriage because they feel that it's nothing more than a shallow legalizing. Now, I realize that you touched upon this in your presentation, but I wonder if you might focus in once again on how and why Judaism views marriage as more than just a shallow legalizing.
As a matter of fact, Judaism contradicts Catholicism, which maintains that this marital community, basically the metaphysical community, it can be only created, formed by some transcendental power. That's life to them, and marriage is a sacrifice. We believe that marriage is a human institution, created by community. But it's not a legalizer. This is the word, I don't find the word legalizer. It is, basically marriage is a covenant. It's an agreement. It resembles life in a variety of ways.
the covenantal community, the historical covenantal community. But the covenant itself, when you rest upon a voluntary commitment on both parts, on the part of both partners, in the historical covenantal community, God is one, the partner, the other partner is the charismatic community, charismatic people of Israel. But it is a community created by human hands, human commitment, and human faith. And you haven't said, the problem really bothered you haven't, this problem was there. The problem is actually you have to explore and investigate so many times, very carefully. The problem is that it's a physiological function. The animal is dominated by the sex urge as well as man. Yes. How can the sex urge or the sex desire, sexual desire, be reduced from animality and raised to a higher level. You know what the Christianity did? Christianity said sex head is no good. It corrupts in its very essence. This is the monastic philosophy of Christianity. But the others did not deserve it. The others believe that whatever is natural can be sublimated to heaven and raised to new heights. If you inject guilt in the purpose in there, and sanctity in there, this can only be done within the community, the marital community. Again, for the marital community is a happy community. The chesed, actually we have no ceremonial for marriage. You do, in Israel, any ceremonial for marriage? There's no ceremonial for marriage. Marriage means an agreement, a covenant. A covenant. But a covenant is based upon the assent of the two partners. It is a commitment. It's a commitment. This commitment which expresses itself in the readiness to serve the idea of Christ. It means in the readiness to transcend myself, my own interest, and take the Tao into my high awareness. And the Tao in the marriage community is not only the other partner, but the child as well. And that's exactly what redeems the sex earth, sex life, and sex love, and raises it to a level of actually acceptance, of meaningfulness, and religious performance.
Rabbi, does the halakha recognize a functional aspect of the sexual urge apart from
What do you call it, functional aspect?
Is it available to both partners in marriage if there is no desire for the procreation?
I didn't understand that question.
What if, for example, the parents should decide that they don't want any children or they have sufficient numbers of children?
That means the matrimonial union is not complete. The community is not supposed to follow me. And being actually, is imperfect.
And just say they have already some children, is there then still some function?
No, this is not this, what if I have a child, I don't have a child. You understand? Of course, in the halakhically, we speak about number of children, but actually the habit is very much opposed. The habit is opposed to birth control, let's not pull out. Never mind the conservative rabbis proclaiming today, I had on the radio, Yadis accepts birth control. It isn't true. Yadis is opposed to birth control. I'll tell you why. First of all, let's explain in my paper here. Because the marital union is, the child completes the marital union. Before the child is born, or if the parents refuse the child, the marital union is incomplete. If the marital union is incomplete, so the redemption of the sex law is not complete.
For it means the whole process of marriage by which you redeem a physiological function and you raise it to a higher level is interrupted. But there is something else which you haven't resented. Every physiological urge expresses itself through pressure. This pressure is discharged, and this pressure, that when I meet this desire, that the pressure is discharged, I derive pleasure. I'm hungry, and hunger pains, this is the kind of pressure, instinctual push, I take food, and I feel satiated, and I enjoy the physical pressure to the right, every day. Of course, in sex life, in the hedonic element powerful, very powerful. It's a very strong urge, which is strong there, except for all this. The pressure is powerful, it's also stronger, because to need to gratify this need, is a source of great matter. However, the sex urge should not only supply men with pleasure. The sex urge and the gratification of the urge should bind them and make them commit themselves morally, ethically, to the attainment of some purpose. There's both. There is always in every act, in every physiological component, according to your habit, to one that has pleasure and to one to sell a commission. To sell a commission.
But Calvin, you were saying that Judaism would not accept the philosophy saying that a child of marriage is just as sacred as one within his
child. Although it is impossible for the child to have a child, for the reason. So the child, so the marriage is sacred, I don't think the marriage is not sacred. If you have the marriage to be complete, if the parents are capable of having a child, but it's simply refused. And again, you see, the marriage institution is a redeeming institution. Perfect is to redeem. The same as the institution of dietary laws, the institution whose purpose is to redeem simply the process of eating from its animality and primitiveness, and relate it to itself, to a meaningful performance. We have a system of dietary laws. We have a system of laws pertaining to sex life, sex law, whose purpose is to redeem sex law, sex life, from naturalness of the caveman or the jungle man, and redeem it to a level of a spiritual motif. Yes. This can only be redeemed if men is ready to accept God. To take pleasure, yes, and to take responsibility. But in controlling, in birth control, what is the idea? I'll take the pleasure. Yes. However, I don't want to commit myself. Nor in control.
Couldn't there be a pleasure?
And this is exactly what you have in prison. It means you want to take pleasure and take responsibility. So what's the difference between the human being who refuse to take responsibility and the animal who doesn't know what responsibility is? Well, his mating is... seasonal mating is just a source of pleasure for him. You have nothing on that.
Well, couldn't they argue that the sense of responsibility would be manifest in a responsibility from one mate to the other? As opposed to being challenged.
Yes, but the responsibility that I developed in paper, responsibility is not only one mate to another. It's responsibility from both to the child. As a matter of fact, one mate for another, if all the mates are independent of each other, usually. They're adults and they can get along with without mutual help. However, the child, you want responsibility of somebody who is completely helpless. And that is the child. as this God. I mean, that's the reason why. You see, why is birth control forbidden according to the law? It's not because the people have also many theories about it, but this is, none of the theories is true. The truth is that we haven't wanted men to redeem the physiological urges and drive by natural, by accepting responsibility. For instance, even without a duty, it means not only you should do it, you should invite others. To die, we need to lose them. Poor people who are incapable to feed themselves. After my beer, etc. Also, in sex life, not to enjoy is not enough. But you have somehow, you have to commit yourself to someone else. And take responsibility. And that's exactly the child. The role of the child in the Jewish matrimonial union is central. I'll tell you other things to tell you as soon as I finish.
Then following up on that, when the child grows and when all the children grow up, does the marriage once again lose its completeness?
No, I didn't say that. I mean, I fulfilled my duty. I fulfilled my duty. It's not a question that should be continued. The boundary line that to lead the child is supposed to care for father and mother.
According to what you're saying, would it then be feasible, or I should say, proper according to halacha, that if parents could not have children in order to, let us say, fulfill the community which they should be creating, that they should then adopt the child?
Basically, I'll say frankly, adoption of a child is not a Jewish institution. It is a Roman institution. Why? For simple reasons. There is no need to adopt a child. If one cannot have a child, you can get a child. You cannot fight, you can have a child. You know by what? By teaching. By teaching. The most important place, whether I teach my own son, I mean, that's all that I say, commitment to the unborn child is not only consists of the fact that I'll have to feed a child, nurse the baby, infant. More than that, it's an educational thing. It's a commitment, a masoretic commitment, as person life, as transmitted. Of course, this can be accomplished not only with the natural child, but with any child. The word adoption is completely superfluous. That's why the argument did not know in the future the woman's looks upon children as the property of the parents. So of course, if it is the property of the parents, if you cannot have children, so you adopt to buy it. The argument did not look upon children. As the property of parents. The child is a part of the parental existential awareness. But he's a part because the child succeeds the father. He will not succeed. I mean, as far as business is concerned, he will inherit his father. As far as he must survive the father will continue. He continues. Father takes the child as he. You need a right. I must tell you, many times I'm not critical of your choice. I don't know it's hard. Objective matter. You know very well that my grandmother told me when I heard my grandmother tell us the way she was playing in the yard, she was playing in the yard. She was 12 years old. We are friends. So suddenly her mother came out of the house and said, Gute, come in. She came in, Mazel Tov. You are engaged. Now, she was 12, my grandfather, when it was written, was 15. I can tell you there was no ideal marital community that created their house. I can tell you, I still remember the child, the devotion to each other, the love for each other, and the harmony of the way it was actually. But however, she had no criteria which to choose because she didn't choose.
Well, the conversation shows that we can, in the course of a short period of time, only begin. Our rabbis compare Torah to the sea, endless in depth and in breadth. Yet it is as available to each of us as we wish it. We have no words in which we can thank Rabbi Soloveitchik for sharing Torah with us this evening. And we thank you for being here.
Thank you, everyone.
Somebody want to go over him?